Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 1st of May, these are our main stories. Sudan's rival military factions have announced a new ceasefire, but are showing no sign of stopping fighting. Moscow has confirmed that it sacked the minister in charge of logistics in Ukraine, with major problems keeping Russian forces supplied. At the end of his three-day visit to Hungary, Pope Francis urges worshippers not to close the door on migrants. Also in this podcast, a first for China as Ding Liren becomes the country's first male world chess champion.
His road here and the fact that he won might be one of the greatest comeback stories in sports. I mean, it's incredible what it has taken him to get here. And I just really hope he gets a chance to enjoy.
Sudan's rival military factions have announced a new three-day ceasefire but have shown no sign of ending their fight for the capital, Khartoum. The paramilitary Rapid Support Forces are still reported to control much of the city. The Sudanese army has been bombing their positions and urging RSF fighters to surrender. For the city's millions of inhabitants, life is now a cruel game of survival as food, water and power grow increasingly scarce, quite apart from the threat from bullets and bombs. Political analyst Hamid Kalafala's neighbourhood in Khartoum is dotted with RSF checkpoints. James Menendez asked him, how does he negotiate these checkpoints, or is it simply too dangerous to try?
It's basically a gamble. Sometimes they let you through, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they shoot at you, sometimes they steal your things. And it's very random. You know, be friendly, throw in a joke, but don't be too friendly, but don't be too funny. At the end, it's nothing guaranteed. You could do everything that you were told to do and still get a shot. Or they would let you through. It's difficult to tell how they would react.
Just thinking about what there is available, I mean, do you have running water, for example, at the moment, or do you have to go out to get?
No,
so there's no running water.
Not at all.
Do you have power?
Today we have power. It works for 2 days, then it gets cut for another 2 days. But water, we haven't had a single drop of water ever since fighting erupted on the 15th of April, and today is the 30th.
Gosh. And so where do you get your water from? You just have to buy it, what, in bottles? Or is there somewhere you can go and fill up canisters?
That was the first day. Some of the houses to neighborhoods away from us would have wells in their houses. They would open it for people to go and get. So every day or every other day, we have these huge water containers. We go, we fill it, we come back to use it for whatever we need. Eventually, we end up drinking it as well, although it's not very safe for drinking, but there are no other options. So, yeah, it's quite difficult.
And is there a lot of that sort of neighbourly solidarity at the moment, people helping each other with food, with water and with money and so on?
Absolutely. This is how people survived. There is no state to support citizens. The alleged state is part of the warring parties, so they're not providing any services. So people had to resort to their communities. Whoever has food would share it with their neighbors. There are WhatsApp groups where people communicate about households that are running out of food, so everyone else would try to give them a bit of food. People would give them some water. So yeah, people have been doing all of that in complete absence of support from any external actors.
Yeah. How do you feel about the evacuation of foreigners from the city?
It's important to get them out, but what's wrong is to only focus on getting foreign nationals out and not focusing on getting also Sudanese nationals who are caught at crossfire to safe places, or at least open safe passages or humanitarian corridors to get them assistance where they are. And I think this is why a lot of people and myself would feel abandoned. Thousands were taken out, but there are millions left behind who are suffering in this very difficult situation.
I mean, at the moment, could you leave the city? Could you drive out of the city or get on a bus if you wanted to?
It is possible, but it's very risky. So getting on a car to the bus station where buses would take you outside Khartoum, that journey is also quite difficult to go across a lot of checkpoints. You might get into areas where active fighting is happening. It's quite difficult and dangerous and risky, and people kind of also support each other by recommending safe routes based on their experience, but it's still quite risky. And then getting a bus from there to the borders is also difficult. You could go to the bus station and wait for a couple of days until there's a bus to take you, and it's becoming very expensive. Like, prices have skyrocketed because of the shortage of fuel, because of lack of regulation of prices at this moment, and so on. Then you would get to the borders, and this is where the huge humanitarian crisis is unfolding in very hot weather, over 40 degrees Celsius in the middle of the desert, a very difficult, humiliating, and expensive trip. I would have to think about it twice before I make it. Am I safer at home? Well, and I'm not safe at home at all, but is it safer to stay, or is it safer to leave and try to make that risky trip?
Khartoum resident Hamid Kalafala. So what of the announcement of an extension to the ceasefire? Will Ross is our Africa regional editor.
The two warring sides have both issued statements saying that they agree to a three-day extension of the ceasefire. Many people will look at that and just wonder whether it's worth anything, those words, because of what's gone on over the last 2 weeks. We've had several ceasefires that didn't start at all. In the case of the current one, which has already been extended once by 3 days, it's been repeatedly broken, especially in Khartoum, where throughout Sunday there was quite heavy fighting. We understand the rapid support forces control quite large areas, and it seems the Sudanese military has been using a lot of its firepower, so bombing from the air, to try and dislodge these RSF fighters. There are possibly as many as 7 million people living in the city who are stuck in their homes. A very worrying time. It's kind of difficult to know what's going to happen next, but they have announced at least that they're going to extend this ceasefire, but I don't think anybody kind of expects them to commit to it, sadly.
Will Ross. Well, after days of appeals to the warring parties to allow access for aid, the first consignment of medical supplies since the conflict began 2 weeks ago has landed at Port Sudan, more than 800 kilometres from Khartoum. Patrick Youssef, Africa Regional Director for the International Committee of the Red Cross, told me what medical supplies they had managed to bring in on Sunday.
Today's consignment consists basically of surgical material, war wounded kits, but also dressing kits, enough to sustain and support over 1,500 war wounded. Hopefully this will be the first batch of many, and the challenge indeed is not only to get them to Sudan, but to deliver them actually to the hospitals, to the primary healthcare centers, and to all the health posts that indeed require that assistance.
So what do hospitals need?
Well, first and foremost, they need security. The reports that we're hearing are unfortunately those of many health personnel that are unable to join their medical facilities. In normal times, a hospital would require restocking every 2 or 3 days. And in this case, with a flux of war wounded, you can imagine that they need everything from dressing kits to medicines. And indeed, the situation is extremely dire in Khartoum and in Darfur. The World Health Organization announced that over 60% of the hospitals are out of service.
Now, this first consignment of aid has landed in Port Sudan. It's a long way, what, more than 840 kilometres to the capital, Khartoum. Are you confident that you'll be able to get the aid there?
I truly hope that in the dialogue we've established with the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces, that we'll be able to deliver these with the Sudanese Red Crescent. And I hope truly that in communicating also openly with the health directorate, with the hospitals themselves, that we'll be able to assess which locations are a top priority. Our intention really is to now call on parties to the conflict to make sure that these consignments are delivered.
Patrick Youssef, Africa Regional Director of the ICRC. Well, as fighting continues in Khartoum and other areas, tens of thousands of civilians have already abandoned their homes and fled Sudan. Thousands of others are still trying to flee. Western governments have evacuated thousands of citizens by flights, but many countries, like Saudi Arabia, are taking people from Port Sudan on a 10-hour crossing across the Red Sea to the Saudi coastal city of Jeddah.
I was working in the Sudan for the last 13 years, and due to the situation of peace and security here, due to this war, I left everything, my house, my car, my everything.
Finally, we are on board. They managed to get everyone on board without any kind of mishap. They served us sweets and water, and they have been looking after us.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has also been on an evacuation mission between Port Sudan and Jeddah, chartered by the Saudi military. It says it has so far rescued more than 5,000 people of 100 different nationalities.
Both sides, huh?
You're going to put up lights on both sides of the of the warship?
Yeah, both sides.
To illuminate the port?
Yes.
In the early hours of the morning, after more than 10 hours at sea, the Saudi warship approached the coast of Sudan, switching on searchlights to ensure safe passage. This major international rescue goes on around the clock, and Saudi Arabia is playing a major role. Thousands have fled to Sudan's eastern shore, overwhelming this port city. We dock in an area where there is an orderly queue. This time it's mainly young men from South Asia. Another, Anoush from Nepal, told us they'd waited 3 days here.
Very happy to go to Nepal.
And you hope to come back to Sudan?
No.
I don't. It's finished. After a 10-hour journey back to the Saudi coast, people arriving at the main naval base in Jeddah are met by diplomats from their own countries as well as aid officials. Until the boats land, it's not clear who's on board. Britain, like many other countries, keeps watch here night and day. Cecile El-Beledi is Britain's Consul General.
We're ready for anybody who's coming across along with the Saudis. The situation is changing, as you can appreciate, all of the time. I know it's a very difficult situation, but our paramount sort of focus is the safety of our British nationals and to make sure that we look at the range of options in a very dynamic, movable situation to make sure that we find the safest and most efficient way out for them. We are preparing for everything.
You can feel the exhaustion and relief on both sides of this Red Sea crossing. But there's anxiety and anger too. They arrive knowing they've left behind so many Sudanese friends and family who have no way to escape this descent into violence.
Lise Doucette ending that report in Saudi Arabia. Now to Russia, which has sacked its deputy defence minister, who doubles as the officer in charge of armed forces logistics. Colonel General Mikhail Mezintsev has been blamed for continued logistical problems with the invasion of Ukraine. Our Europe regional editor is Pomos.
The news of General Mezintsev's sacking was hardly a surprise. Russia's invasion of Ukraine continues to be dogged by problems keeping troops supplied, shortages of food, even of uniforms. And the head of the Wagner mercenary group said on Sunday that a lack of ammunition could make a Ukrainian counteroffensive a tragedy for Russia. General Mezintsev will be replaced by Alexei Kuzmenkov, an official from Russia's National Guard. This was set up by Vladimir Putin to protect the country internally and reports directly to the president.
Paul Moss. Pope Francis has ended a visit to Hungary lasting 3 days with an outdoor mass in the capital, Budapest. He appealed to Hungarians to be more open to migrants, with the country's Prime Minister Viktor Orban in the congregation. The political leader has repeatedly criticised migration and was responsible for constructing a wall to stop people from crossing the border from neighbouring Serbia and Croatia. Our correspondent Nick Thorpe reports from the central square in Budapest, where tens of thousands attended the religious celebration.
In warm spring sunshine, Pope Francis arrived in Kossuth Square in Budapest to celebrate Mass with a congregation of tens of thousands. This was the climax of his three-day visit and his main opportunity to speak to the Hungarian public. In his sermon, he urged his listeners to open their doors to those who are foreign or unlike us towards migrants and the poor. It was a bold message in a country where government policy has made migrant a pejorative word. But the Pope was also careful throughout his trip to praise the history and culture and the pro-family policies of his hosts. He finished with a prayer for peace for the tortured people of Ukraine and the people of Russia.
Nick Thorpe in Budapest. Still to come.
Hey! Welcome to Amsterdam on steroids. This is what a legal, responsible cannabis store should look like.
It's 10 months since Thailand radically changed its drugs policy by legalizing the cultivation and consumption of marijuana. Not everybody is happy. We'll be back right after this.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair. Hours after her death, the only suspect in the case fled the UK to Yemen. He's never been questioned by the police. I'm Noelle El-Makafi, and I made a promise to Martina's family 15 years ago to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair. Part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. In the Central Asian Republic of Uzbekistan, people have been voting in a referendum to change the constitution. The most eye-catching plan is to extend the president's term in office from 5 to 7 years. But there are other proposals, as I heard from our Central Asia correspondent, Rehan Dimitri.
Pretty much every article of the old constitution has been altered. Things have been added. There were over 200,000 proposals from the citizens of Uzbekistan, that's according to the government, over the past year, kind of suggesting which parts of the constitution should be amended. And that's how the government has been presenting it, that this new constitution is all about prioritizing the rights of an individual over state, and it's in line with President Shavkat Mirziyoyev's strategy for new Uzbekistan. But, of course, most attention has been drawn to that specific article that will extend the presidential term from 5 to 7 years. And what would it mean for the country? Because the current president, he is in his second term, which will finish in 2026. And if he runs according to the new constitution, it means that he might stay in power up to 2040. How that will be done technically, it's not clear. There are talks that there might be kind of Putin style zeroing out his first two terms because now there's a new constitution, but it looks like Uzbekistan is heading that way.
Rehan Dimitri on the referendum in Uzbekistan. Early results are expected on Monday. An Israeli army officer has been removed from his post after joining street protests earlier this week while wearing his uniform. The major, who's not been named, had demonstrated in support of government plans to overhaul the judiciary. More from our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
Israeli army officers up to the rank of major are allowed to take part in protests, but not in uniform. The major involved in this incident was also carrying his weapon, compounding his offence. The judicial reforms have deeply divided Israel's armed forces as well as the country at large. Despite huge street protests on both sides, the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he's confident that an agreement can be reached on the proposed overhaul.
Mike Thompson. Here in the UK, with less than a week to go, plans are gathering pace for the coronation of King Charles in Westminster Abbey. Lambeth Palace, the official London residence of the Archbishop of Canterbury, has released new details about the service on Saturday. People around the country will be asked to join in swearing allegiance to the King, and non-Christian faith leaders will participate for the first time. The Archbishop of York, Stephen Cottrell, says he hopes the service will unite the UK.
I hope people will sing and raise a glass and say a prayer and join in, and also join in the other things that are happening around the coronation, the street parties, but also on the Monday, the big help out. That, again, strikes that note of service. It's a time for us all to get stuck in.
Our religion editor, Ali McBull, has more details on the coronation service.
This will still be a traditional religious coronation service, but Lambeth Palace has revealed several striking changes to the last one in 1953. Most notably, perhaps, will be an invitation, not just to those in the Abbey, but people watching, to join what they're calling a chorus of millions in together swearing an oath of allegiance to the King and his heirs. During the service, the King himself will pray out loud. In spite of much speculation over the years, the King's oath will not change to include a vow to protect the practice of any faith or belief, but the Archbishop of Canterbury will state that aspiration. There will, though, be participation of faith leaders of Catholic and non-Christian traditions and, for the first time, a role for women bishops.
Ali McBull. Craig Prescott, a constitutional lawyer here in the UK, told the BBC's Luquesa Barak more about why the coronation pledge has been introduced.
It has to be viewed in the context of the service itself. And what it's doing is replacing the homage of the peerage. And it goes with the general tenor of the service, which is to try and broaden out, you know, those who are involved in the service. And I think its primary effect will be in the Abbey itself, where you will have presumably most, if not all, of those attending paying homage at the same time. And I think televisually that will be quite an effective moment. What's interesting is, of course, is that there is an invitation for those outside the Abbey to take part as well, you know, reflecting that the monarchy today is really based on popular support more than anything. So it is an invitation for the public to get involved.
Do you think that's how the public have read it, though? The wider message, because it's a new aspect of the ceremony and it is open. It's an invitation to all British subjects. The audience around the world, compared to those within the building when the ceremony is taking place, will be very different. Don't you think the message will be read slightly differently, interpreted differently as well?
It may well be. I think, you know, if we put ourselves forward to that Saturday, there will be some people who have chosen to watch it on a large screen in a sort of communal setting. And it may be that some of those people will get involved, whereas those, obviously, who have chosen not to watch the coronation at all or anything, obviously won't do. So I think this is very much a matter of individual choice. And, you know, people will act according to the choices. It may sort of perhaps look quite odd, sort of perhaps outside of the UK. But that is, you know, inevitable with an event like this, which is, you know, primarily a state event for the UK, but one attracting interest from around the world.
Constitutional lawyer Craig Prescott. Last year, Thailand radically changed its drugs policy by legalising the cultivation and consumption of marijuana. A country once famous for its harsh penalties for drug use adopted overnight one of the world's most liberal marijuana regimes, setting off a boom in cannabis-related businesses. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports from Bangkok.
Yet another marijuana dispensary opens in Bangkok. There are already several hundred in this city, only 10 months after it was fully legalised. A weed bonanza which has stunned those accustomed to the uncompromisingly punitive approach to narcotics that we used to see in Thailand.
Hey! Welcome to Amsterdam on steroids.
This is the man who's in large part responsible for transforming the official view of cannabis here.
This is what a legal, responsible cannabis store should look like.
Entrepreneur Tom Crucipon says he saw how big the business was becoming in the United States, and he persuaded the man who's now Thailand's health minister to adopt legalization as a central plank of his party's manifesto at the last election.
You know, people misunderstand. People think that cannabis is just about getting high. It's a culture.
It's also about business. That's the reason Tom has opened a branch of the well-known US cannabis chain, Cookies, in Bangkok.
You have a market of 66 million people, but then the tourists. You have 43 million tourists who visit Thailand every year, Chinese, Japanese. Add that on to the market in Thailand, you're going to have a few billion-dollar companies here, I guarantee it.
Well, I'm going to describe where we've come to, somewhere on the outskirts of Bangkok. There's a pile of containers. I'm going up a staircase to the second floor of the containers, and inside there are a lot of bright lights. There's a fan blowing out a very, very strong smell of cannabis. And in this one container, it's filled with young green cannabis plants. And there are businesses like this all over Bangkok, improvised, small-scale cottage industries that have just sprung up to take advantage of the drastically new legal environment in Thailand.
A lot of people don't know what is legal.
Is everything legal?
Not everything is legal. What you can and you can't do is not out yet.
Kitty Chopaka, who brought me to the containers, is a veteran of the cannabis scene in Thailand and a long-standing campaigner for legalisation. She says she's glad it's happened, but worries about the almost complete lack of regulation.
I want it regulated because there's no rules right now. But at the same time, I've come to terms with that this is how it's going to be done because this is Thailand. You know, with all the potential for everything to kind of fall apart. But without it, this wouldn't happen.
The reason there are no rules is that Thailand's parliament has failed to pass them. And that's because many MPs oppose the new policy, some out of genuine concern over public health risks, others more out of political opportunism. This MP from the opposition Pheutai Party warns that they will push to recriminalise marijuana if they win next month's election. Those who've invested in Thailand's marijuana gold rush, like Tom Krusapon, also recognise that without at least some regulations, there's a risk of a backlash.
I don't like free-for-all. I think it creates a misunderstanding. It makes a legal thing look illegal. You should have a licence to be able to dispense cannabis because, as in anything, what we don't want to do, we don't want to kill the golden goose. And I think if this free-for-all continues, the golden goose will die.
As things stand right now, Thailand has one of the most liberal cannabis regimes anywhere in the world. But no one is sure where this brave, somewhat hazy new world will be next year.
That report by Jonathan Head in Thailand. The Russian fashion designer Vyacheslav Zaitsev, who was referred to as the Soviet Christian Dior, has died at the age of 85. His colourful collections won international acclaim, but he faced suspicion from the Soviet authorities, as Bernadette Kehoe explains.
Popularly known as Slava, Russia's most famous couturier achieved global success with bright dresses adorned with the flower patterns found on traditional Russian shawls. Vivid colours matching his flamboyant personality. His first collection in the early 1960s, a uniform for female workers that included multicoloured boots, attracted international attention, but was rejected by the Soviet authorities. He later reflected that the brightness contrasted with the greyness of Soviet everyday life, where an individual should not stand out.
Bernadette Kehoe. Ding Liren has become China's first male world chess champion after defeating Russian-born Yan Nepomuchi in a tense, rapid-play tiebreak match in Kazakhstan's capital, Astana. The Chinese grandmaster took the crown from the Norwegian five-time world champion Magnus Carlsen, who chose not to defend his title. Ding Liren's victory means China holds both the men's and women's titles. James Menendez heard more about the match from the American chess international master and commentator Levi Rosman, also known as Gotham Chess.
It was unbelievably close. It was 18 games in total. The 14 classical portion, meaning the long games, was 7-7, and it was a plot twist until the very end. Even the very last game could have been won by Nepomniachtchi. And then today's tiebreaker, there was nothing to choose between them, the first three and the fourth one. The first time that Ding Liren took the lead in the match, he won it. Now he's the world champion.
Tell us about him. How long has he been playing?
He's 30, 31 years old. He's been playing since about 5 and 6. And he's been at the top for a long time. But his ability to contend with the other top players was severely hindered. There was a lot of travel restrictions for him coming out of China. frankly, his road here and the fact that he won might be one of the greatest comeback stories in sports in, I really don't know, to be frank with you. I mean, it's incredible what it has taken him to get here. And it's sensational. I mean, I just really hope he gets a chance to enjoy.
There has been a bit of sniping from the sidelines about whether the match was undermined by the fact that Magnus Carlsen decided not to defend his title. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I had some convoluted thoughts, right? I mean, on the one hand, if you want to say that the best chess player in the world right now is also the world champion, that probably isn't an accurate sentence. I mean, Magnus Carlsen, until the title is literally taken from him in a one-on-one match, is probably still the best chess player walking the planet, not just in classical format, in the long format, in a rapid format, 25 minutes per side, in a blitz format, 3-5 minutes per side. On the other hand, he didn't defend his title. And the truth is, if you don't defend the title, then, well, you're no longer the classical world champion. So we'll see if he makes a comeback officially to the match. But on the other hand, I thought we should still promote the heck out of this match. Okay, we don't have Magnus, but I don't want to, even before the match begins, sit there and go, well, this is not the real champion. You know, who am I to say that? I'm like number 3,500 in the world. You know what I mean?
Levi Rosman. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.